Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Friday, November 4th. Today, reporter Kevin Simpson talks with author Ted Conover about his new book, Cheap Land Colorado, Choosing Life Off the Grid in the San Luis Valley. The two discuss why we need to understand the isolated subculture of the valley's flats in a time of political extremes. Before we continue, a message from our sponsors at Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy can help you find ways to keep your home or business running smoothly while reducing energy use and saving you money. Find everyday tips for using less energy and simple ways to manage your energy budget at xcelenergy.com. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. Although Colorado Republicans tallied the most votes in an election held on this date in 1924, the Ku Klux Klan appeared to be the real winner. An organization that believed itself to be the voice of all true Americans, the white Protestant Klan advocated ethnic and religious unity against the perceived threats of African Americans, Jews, Catholics, and immigrants. Unlike the shadowy post-Civil War Klan, this new nativist version proudly paraded itself in public. Colorado's branch of the Klan emerged from a meeting at Denver's Brown Palace Hotel in 1921. As many as 1 in 7 Denverites joined the Klan, which gained followers statewide. Grand Dragon John Locke led rallies at a stadium near the University of Denver, sponsored events at Denver amusement parks, and held cross burnings atop South Table Mountain near Golden. Chapters even held bake sales and food drives for people who shared their views. Locke allied with Democrat Benjamin Stapleton to become mayor in 1923. By the November 1924 election, Klan members had infiltrated the Republican Party and elected their favorite candidate to the governor's office and to fill a vacancy in the U.S. Senate. Non-member U.S. Senator Lawrence Phipps bankrolled the Klan to aid his own re-election. It won a majority of the Colorado House of Representatives, but Democrats and non-Klan Republicans stymied the Klan in the state Senate. Resistance in the General Assembly limited the group's power in early 1925, as did Denver Judge Benjamin Lindsay and District Attorney Philip Van Cise. For his part, Stapleton eventually turned against the Klan and used World War I veterans in the American Legion to raid illegal bars and gambling dens that funded the group. In the face of such legal and moral embarrassments, Klan membership dissipated even as its attitudes lingered. Before we continue, the Colorado Sun invites you to attend Health Insurance Headaches virtually on November 16th from 6 to 7 p.m. Health reporter John Ingold will talk with experts about different Colorado health insurance options, shopping tips, and more. Registration is free and available at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Hello, Colorado. I'm Sun writer Kevin Simpson, and we're happy to be talking today to Ted Conover, the Colorado-raised author who now lives in New York, where he teaches journalism at New York University when he isn't writing books. Thanks for joining us, Ted, and congratulations on your latest nonfiction release earlier this week of Cheap Land Colorado, Off-Gridders at America's Edge.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks a lot.
So this is the first book title I can think of that's actually named after internet search terms. So tell us why is that, and give us some of the basics about the book and why you felt this subject and this landscape where it's set were important to address.
Sure. Well, we should start with the title because I even had to explain to my editor why there shouldn't be a comma after land. It's just Cheap Land Colorado, and I thought, that's a perfect title because it's what so many people I've met out on the prairie of the San Luis Valley Googled in order to find their land. They were looking for cheap land in Colorado, and that's where it is, down in the San Luis Valley. These 5-acre lots for $3,000 to $6,000 a piece, and they're so cheap because so many were created back in the 1970s by these sort of quick subdivisions that there's an oversupply. But anyway, real estate's part of the book, but a bigger part of the book, I guess, is my curiosity about people who choose to live out in the middle of nowhere, who will put up with the the wind and the cold and the lack of services, the lack of utilities to get fresh water. You have to basically drill a well, which is quite expensive. And yeah, there's very little other than sort of natural beauty, some of the year anyway, to bring people out there. But I was interested in people who don't feel they fit into the mainstream and who value independence and the independence that comes with owning your own place above practically anything else, certainly above comfort, because they sacrifice that, I think, in many cases in order to live out there on the prairie.
And so did you feel that this was a particularly good time to address that particular issue, given just sort of the state of affairs in the United States at this point?
Sure. I had wondered about that kind of life for years, but happened to take a drive through a part of South Park that I had not explored when I was younger, the part sort of south of Hartsel, which was also subdivided in the 70s. And it was around the time when Donald Trump was becoming a credible candidate for president. And I think, like others in my profession, journalism and academia, others who live in cities like New York, I was surprised that he won. And I thought it reflected poorly on me. It seemed I should know why so many people support him and his ideas. And I thought that a closer look at people in one of these more sort of isolated and extreme homesteading kinds of areas, I knew they tended to skew right in their politics. And I made a couple trips to the San Luis Valley to look into this, and that was confirmed. And I thought, you know, this is a perfect time to write about this. And because it reflects, I think, on our national state of affairs. I think as I've gotten to know people in some of these far-flung places, I've come to see their isolation as a metaphor, really, for feelings of exclusion and disparagement. And I think that MAGA taps into that. So yeah, it seemed like the right time to go.
So this book, like others that you've written, uses a technique of immersion to gain a particular perspective during your reporting. So and you are the expert on immersion. You actually teach it back there. But tell us about some of your previous experiences with immersive reporting and why you chose to immerse yourself in the flats of the San Luis Valley. What made it the right way to proceed?
Sure. So the book I'm best known for is called New Jack, Guarding Sing Sing. And to research that, I became a New York State corrections officer. This is in the very late 1990s, right after I moved to New York. And I did it without the knowledge of the people who run that system, because they had told me that I was not welcome to spend more than an afternoon in any of their prisons, and it would be on an official tour. I had an assignment from the New Yorker magazine, actually. And I thought, well, that's not right. This isn't national security at stake here. This is, you know, a public service. It's hugely expensive. It's locking up so many people. Why can't a journalist go there and spend some time? And so that was, first of all, a way to get in. But second, as you know, a journalist on a deadline doesn't have time to always ask all the questions that are important and doesn't have time to get to know people in a way that will allow them to trust you some of the time. And corrections is especially like that. It's so stigmatized as a profession that I found once I had the job, I learned so much more than I ever could have as a person asking questions, right, with a notepad in my hand. So I think a lot of subjects are like that. You know, my first book's about railroad hobos, and the second is about immigrants from Mexico. And I just have time and again turned to this approach because I think it gives deeper insights than you can get on a short deadline. And it kind of dovetails with what they call participant observation in the social sciences, right? The closer you get to something, to becoming a participant, the more you learn in many ways. And so I wanted that firsthand participant kind of intimacy with off-grid living. I didn't want to do a flyby. I wanted to know it up close.
So you embedded yourself intermittently down there over a period of time. And I'm wondering, as I was reading the book, I wondered, how do you plan for this, for immersive reporting? What kind of timeline is there? What kind of logistical preparation was involved in Chiefland, Colorado? Or did you basically just kind of make it up as you went along?
I teach. I have to be in a classroom a certain amount of time, and I'm lucky in that I have the kind of teaching job that lets me take a few months off now and then, because that's what this required. I found that a good way to get to know people out on the prairie was to volunteer for this group in Alamosa called La Puente, which had a rural outreach initiative meant to keep these folks from becoming homeless this time of year when it gets cold, because a lot of them don't have the resources to have enough firewood or propane. You know, it's pretty punishing. So I asked, you know, I said, hey, could I assist this effort? Because I admire it. I like what you're doing. And after we got to know each other, they said, yeah, that would be good. And so I was able to tag along with the main worker, whose name was Matt Little, who explained to me how you drive up to a prairie homestead, you know, occupied by somebody who probably is not looking forward to meeting you and may be afraid you're there to steal their marijuana and probably has a dog. And then, and Matt's theory was, if they're flying an American flag, they probably have a firearm too. And I found that was generally true. But he was great because he comes from a sort of a rural West Virginia background. He spent part of his early life off grid. He's a veteran. He's really a sharp and excellent guy. And he sort of tutored me in what to wear and how to introduce myself. And so that was how I got to meet people. And then I'd say, and by the way, I'm a writer. You can Google me. And I want to write about life out here. And most people were so surprised that I would be interested in them. But I was, and I still am. You know, there's so much to know, not just in survival skills, how you stay warm at night during the winter, but yeah, how you deal with neighbors who are a little bit paranoid, or, you know, there's so much craziness out there in terms of people who are preppers and people who have different substance abuse problems. There's also perfectly healthy people out there with kids doing homeschooling, but then you meet people with some extreme religious views. You just don't know what you're going to find.
And so you actually, and one of the most fascinating parts of the book, I think, is just sort of your own assimilation into the culture there. You found some land and settled in. Tell us about that experience.
Oh, man. I thought, you know, I should have more skin in the game. I thought if I actually own land myself, it would change things in a good way. And the question was where to buy it. And a big problem down there is if you leave something of value on your property and you're not there, after a while, parts of it might disappear because there's a lot of need out there on the prairie and a big appetite for whatever, you know, wood, windows, copper, wiring, pretty much anything's at risk if you just leave it. And so after I'd been there, gosh, 2 or 3 years, I met a bunch of people who I thought would be good neighbors. And one of them had a lot that was for sale next to his. And I thought that would be great because I really like this guy. His name is Troy, and he's now my neighbor. And having that kind of relationship changes everything. I've had to figure out with Troy where the fence line is. And Troy's helped me understand how to fix my fence so that the cows don't rub up against my camper trailer at night and scare me to death. And Troy explains, you know, why it might make sense for me to have a firearm, since the sheriff's office seldom is able to respond as quickly as people out there might want it to. So, yeah, stuff like that. It made a big difference when I bought my own land.
So you had a release event for your book earlier this week in Denver that included a chat with Colorado Senator John Hickenlooper. I'm wondering, what would you like the broader conversation about your book to sound like?
I would be so happy if my book could be seen as modeling a kind of discourse where, instead of trolling each other on social media, people who disagree could could meet up, could hang out, could work on common projects, could talk about their kids and all the things we have in common, which is most of them, is my belief, rather than the few political hot button issues that get amplified on social media and seem to turn into this chasm that's now so great it threatens democracy. And I just think we're looking at our computer screens too much and not talking to people who could be our neighbors, or not considering other people as possible neighbors who could make good ones. So yeah, if there's a lesson in my book, it's that a person like me can spend time in a place like that and actually get something out of it. And hopefully the people down there get something out of knowing me. Fingers crossed. I hope so.
Well, I know from experience, a lot of journalists who spend lots of time reporting a story often reach a point where they're just ready to move on. And I'm wondering, since you actually bought property down there during your reporting, if you've held on to it, or do you even return to it from time to time?
So I was actually there 3 weeks ago, and that was the fourth time I was there this summer. My book has been done since the start of the year, so I don't need to go there technically, but it's part of my life, and in a good part, it makes my life fuller and more interesting. I love the contrast with New York in terms of the space and the expense and the ease of finding green chili and all kinds of things about life down there agree with me. So I'm lucky to be married to somebody who doesn't mind if I'm there some of the time, and in fact, even will visit herself now and then. So it's not like when I quit my corrections job, I was so happy to not have to spend another day in Sing Sing. But you know, that was an experience of confinement and of people angry at that confinement. And you know, the flats out where I live, it's an experience of freedom in many ways. And in terms of self-determination, a lot of people feel like that. And I gotta say, it's in the air. And I think the Valley, you know, contrary to other rural places in America that are kind of in decline, it feels like a place full of possibility. And I just like it. So is there another book? I don't know. I don't know how I can keep justifying this, but I really do like it.
Well, listeners can learn more about Ted Conover and Cheap Land Colorado at the Sunlit feature on the Colorado Sun's homepage. That's coloradosun.com. And you can find Cheap Land Colorado at fine bookstores everywhere. Thanks for joining us, Ted.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Election officials and law enforcement are investigating a suspicious substance that was found this week in a 2022 ballot envelope submitted in Adams County. The county clerk said the initial testing indicates the substance is non-toxic, but it will take as many as 5 days before officials know for sure if the substance is benign. Officials said a fairly significant amount of the substance was found coming from the envelope. Some cooking substances were found in the powder, along with an unknown chemical. A program that pays up to 15 months of rent on behalf of Coloradans who struggled financially during the pandemic closes to newcomers on November 15th. But it's not over just yet. State officials said there is still money left in Colorado's share of the Federal Emergency Rental Assistance Program. Those who apply by the deadline will be vetted and may receive financial help. According to the state's Department of Local Affairs, more than 36,000 Colorado households have already benefited. Colorado candidates and political groups again are focused on Latino voters ahead of the election. That's especially true in the state's new 8th congressional district, where 39% of the population is Latino, the largest share of any congressional district in the state. Candidates are advertising on Spanish-language TV and radio and in Spanish-language publications. Political parties and outside groups are registering Latino voters and knocking on their doors. National observers believe the 8th District is a political laboratory for reaching Latino voters and could be replicated across the country. If you need help understanding the state races or ballot measures before Tuesday's election, check out our voter guide at coloradosun.com. Finally, we'd like to correct an error in yesterday's episode regarding the date House Minority Leader Hugh McKean will be lying in state at the Capitol. This will take place on Thursday, November 10th. For more information on all these stories, visit our website, www.coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again on Monday. Before we go, we encourage you to check out a new podcast from our friends at KUNC called The Colorado Dream. Here's a sneak peek.
The new season of The Colorado Dream explores the Black immigrant experience in Aurora. It's told through the eyes of one African woman.
I would sit on the beach and just daydream about coming to America.
And the city of Aurora that's working to become an inclusive home for all.
In the last 20 years, we have a new face of the city.
I'm Stephanie Daniel. Join me for The Colorado Dream, Newcomers Welcome. You can find the series at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, a quick message from our editor.
I'm Larry Rickman, editor and co-founder of The Colorado Sun. The Sun is a public benefit corporation, and we rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to produce the nonpartisan, in-depth news that Colorado needs and deserves. Please consider becoming a Sun member for just $5 a month. Learn more at coloradosun.com. Thanks.